The fellowship meal was so fantastic. Was I not right on that? I gave you an advanced, you know, announcement about that this morning. I could just tell from the smell. Terry, was it you that told me that I'd made the bad mistake by filling my plate before I discovered the second line? I have never been somewhere where that happened, where someone's coming along and said, "You have made a bad mistake." And I said, "What?" Because the plate was as full as it could be. "What?" And he said, "There's a second line." And I thought he was kidding. And so I move into the other room, and there it was, the second line. Boy, David, you know, it's a wonder you're not a much bigger man in the brotherhood. Yeah. Yeah, it really, with folks that cook like this, how wonderful. And thank all of you for staying, and for those of you that have come back for our 1:30 service, and for guests like Randy and Mia Medlin from the University Congregation, former students of ours at FHU. We're so grateful to see them, and there could be others that I haven't seen yet, but we're loving every moment of being with you. We appreciate you. Brother and Sister Ed, found out we're related, you know, and little granddaughter, thank you for being here as well, from Wetumpka and from Faulkner. But I must tell you, Terry's made reference to the fact, to the challenge that I have. Not only is it thundering outside, but the challenge of a service like this. I like these, I really do. But we've done them back in Henderson and at Estes through the years for a long time. But here's the problem, and the problem is maintaining your interest during the course of the service, because the overwhelming power of sleep following a meal like that is undeniable. It reminds me of the summer following my freshman year at Freed Hardeman. I'd gone back to my home county, and I was preaching that summer for the Elkins congregation in my home county. There was a brother there that I just loved, him and his wife and their two sons. The two sons were older than I was. They were good athletes. I admired them, looked up to them. This man's name was John B. Travis, and John B. was a big farmer. His sons were big. They were stars. And John B.'s wife's name was Lucy, and Lucy was a fantastic cook. Lucy Ricardo had nothing on Lucy Travis. She was something else. And big personality, great cook, in their home a lot. The problem that I had, John B. led off the service every Sunday morning and every Sunday night. And I noticed eventually that when the song service was over and I came up to the pulpit, and I know I did not know very much, and that may still be the case now, but I definitely didn't know very much then, but I noticed that as soon as the song service was over, John B. was out like a light every single time. And I eventually decided, Brother David, that is not only wrong, that's sinful. And so I mustered the courage one Sunday night. He always was the last to come out of the building. I'd be out on the front steps greeting the brethren, saying, "Look forward to seeing you again next time." And all of them were nice. And John B. would always come out last. And so this Sunday night, I was ready. I was prepared. I mustered up my courage. And as we shook hands with the right hand, and his was twice the size of mine, I held on and I said, "John B., I need to talk to you a moment." He said, "Okay." And I said, "John B., you know I love you. In fact, I've loved you my whole life." In fact, he was the same age as my mother, and they both would live to be about the same age when they passed, not far apart. He was 95 and she was 97. But anyway, we were very close as family, and so I felt, you know, pretty comfortable doing this. I said, "John B., I've got a problem with you. I love you, but I've got a problem with you. I work really hard on my lessons, and I declare you go to sleep on me every single time, and you're the leader up here. It's just not right." And so the grip on the hand became much tighter. As he brought up the left hand and forefinger, he said, "Now you listen to me, Billy. If I didn't trust you, I'd stay awake." Well, I was startled by that. And I said, John B., is that what that means, that you go to sleep on me because you trust? Well, of course that's what it means. I said, well, then sleep on. I said, I don't know very much, and I'm encouraged by your being sleepy. But anyway, you know, as I said, he lived to be 95, and whenever I would go back in the county and hold a meeting or see him somewhere, we enjoyed that story until the time of his death. That's a true one, and I've always enjoyed it very much. I want to tell you that it is difficult speaking on a topic like this for a number of reasons. It's an absolutely necessary topic. In fact, I can recall early in my preaching life that I did not feel comfortable preaching on marriage because Joan and I had been married for such a short time at the time, of course. And then we had small children at the time, and I felt like, well, I'm not really qualified to really say much about marriage or say much about raising children because mine are not raised yet. And then came this lectureship assignment from one of our brotherhood lectureships about God's plan for the home. And I thought, uh-oh, if I accept this, this means that I've got to deal with a topic that really I'm not that experienced on. And then it dawned on me that what I would be dealing with would be not from what I have necessarily experienced, but rather from what the Bible teaches. That's what I was supposed to do, as is always the case. And so sometimes I have made the disclaimer, I may not know this from experience, but I do know it from the inspiration of God's Word. Well, now, 43 years or so later, I know a little bit more about the relationship and about the family, but what we're really looking at is what Paul, by inspiration of God, says about the relationship between husband and wife is like that of the Lord and his relationship with his bride, the church. And from that, I want us to glean principles of how we can help our marriages to be better. I want to tell you why, from my assessment, why it's sometimes difficult to speak on this topic. I know that there are a lot of young people who really are looking forward someday to being married, and the Lord has made us that way, and that's wonderful to anticipate. In fact, we pray about that and wish the very best about that. It's difficult, though, because some of us have lost our mates due to death, and there's also the reality of divorce, even in the church, which really, when I was growing up, in the church, divorce was extremely rare. And so since that time, that has become such a greater reality. And therefore, you want to be as sensitive and sympathetic and empathetic as you possibly can be when you're dealing with so much of your audience that may be affected by that. And then you have marriages where there has been an example of desertion or where there has been disappointment. Maybe every day, every night is disappointment. And so it's not the easiest topic to address. But whatever the Bible teaches is a topic that must be addressed. And so as we think about God's wisdom, we've already referred this morning to the wisdom of the world being foolishness. The wisdom of the world is that which says, well, let me tell you what the concept of marriage for the 21st century is. And then you get into the same-sex marriage and just about everything imaginable that we would never have thought of, not just too terribly long ago. That's the wisdom of the world. The church proclaims the wisdom from God. And yet, as Paul teaches us in Ephesians 4:15, whatever we speak the truth in love. I want us, though, to look at this passage again that on the screen begins with verse 25. You understand that Paul really begins discussing the topic in verse 22 when he talks about the role of wife being the role of submission to the leadership of her husband, which means that the husband is in the role of providing leadership. And it doesn't mean that the wife, too, is not a leader in the home. We know that. We know the home is the queen's castle. We know that. But God has placed man, just like in the church, in the position of providing leadership for which he is accountable to God. And he is going to be accountable for how he's provided leadership, loving leadership, for his wife and for his children. I want us to begin, though, by looking at this verse as we look all the way through verse 33 of Ephesians 5 for principles that hopefully will help our marriages to grow even stronger. I don't care. I heard a story many years ago. One of my heroes through the years, like so many of you, has been the late Brother Gus Nichols. Brother Gus held a gospel meeting at my home congregation my senior year of high school. One afternoon after school, I went and spent an hour and a half with him in his hotel room talking about the nature of the church and other topics, and it was just a wonderful memory. But I remember someone talking about visiting him in Jasper one day, and he was reading a book on marriage, and he'd been married 60 years. And the brother made the observation, Brother Gus, you've been married 60 years. Why in the world would you be reading a book on marriage? And he says, my wife deserves a better husband. And I appreciate that about him. He was still working on that as far as he was concerned. I want us to begin by looking at this verse, husband's love. Husband's love. Now, the very first thing that we need to note as we look at this passage is that Paul is talking to both husbands and wives. In other words, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, but wives, love your husbands as Christ loved the church. It's not one way, is it? It must be two ways. It's not even a 50-50% relationship. It's a 100-100% relationship. But it seems to me, before we talk about qualities that Paul writes by inspiration, that we notice again the word agape, which means benevolent goodwill. Here is someone who lives in relationship with his or her mate who says, I'm going to do what is right toward you. I'm going to do what is best for you. The word agape is not the word that God would use when he talks about the very special, unique, specially reserved for marriage sexual relationship of husband to wife. That would be the word eros, from which we get the word erotic. He doesn't have to tell us about that. That is going to be one of the things that we really look forward to in getting married to begin with, is to enjoy the intimacy of that relationship with someone that we love more than life itself. But what he did know was, once we have that relationship, we may not always treat the other the way that they should be treated. We may not always treat each other with agape love, which means I'm going to do what is right. I'm going to do what is best. This is the word that is used in Matthew 5:48, when in the Sermon on the Mount, the Lord said, love your enemies. And everybody looks at that and says, are you kidding me? I mean, does the Lord know the kind of enemies that I have? And about those that we fight in war, well, again, the word love there would be that we fight even in war according to what is right. That is to say, what the laws of war would be. We do not break the rules. We do not break the laws. In fact, rather than taking the life, if we could take captives rather than taking the lives, that would be a form of loving enemies. But here, husbands love, wives love. And before we get into any other qualities, this is the meaning of it. The qualities that we find in, like, 1 Corinthians 13, the great love chapter, there are 15 virtues there, beginning with verse 4, going through the beginning of verse 8. And in those verses, those virtues are the qualities that we're looking for in our marriage relationship. As we look on then, secondly, he says, love sacrificially. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. There is no greater love than the love that Jesus has for his bride, the church. John 15:13, greater love has no man than this, that he would lay down his life for his friends, but he also laid down his life for his enemies and for every last person on the earth. But especially does he love his bride, the church. To love agape is also to love sacrificially. When we first look at this, we think, well, it means that I would be willing to give my life for my wife. I would be willing to give my life for my children. Here is a wife who would say the same thing. I would be willing to give my life for my husband. I'd be willing to give my life for my children. In fact, that's what you do. I mean, that's just what you do. You constantly give yourself away in behalf of them. But it means more than simply being willing to give your life if, for instance, they were in danger and you were defending them. I really cannot imagine a husband and a father ever giving a thought that if it was her life or mine, it would be mine for her to live. I mean, I cannot imagine a man not thinking that way. I cannot imagine a woman not thinking that way who truly loves her husband or her children. And that has been demonstrated over and over and over again. But it really means more than that. It means that not one of us can possibly have our way all of the time, nor should we expect to have our way all the time. You may have been in homes, as we have been, where there has been what appears to be, and it might have been just simply because there were visitors that day, but where it appears to be just a wonderful mutual relationship of love between husband and wife. I'm sure there have been a lot of those because you've been in a lot of Christian homes. But I'm sure you've also been in homes where one was so dominant, it might have been the husband, it might have been the wife, that the other could not breathe. In fact, you were having trouble breathing because there was so much tension in the relationship. Well, here's a situation where we are giving and taking of ourselves, the giving of ourselves, and yet the taking from our mate all through the course of life. Some years ago, I drove up one beautiful Sunday morning to Lewis County in Middle Tennessee, otherwise known as Hohenwald. Paul, you've been to Hohenwald. And you go to the main light in Hohenwald and you turn left. That is, if you're coming from the west, you turn left and you go out to a community known as Flat Rock. And there was the congregation at Flat Rock where I was invited to hold a meeting that week. And upon getting to the front porch, I greeted all the men who were standing out, you know, the welcoming committee. They were out there on the front porch and I greeted all of them. And then I went inside, worked down the middle aisle, and basically met all the ladies that were already seated, and finally got here on the second row of this section right here where Paul is, and there was a gentleman who jumped up, and he introduced himself as one of the elders of that congregation, and I expressed to him my gratitude for the invitation and for being there that week. And just as quickly, after that little conversation, he proceeded to introduce his wife, of whom he was so proud. I mean, you could just tell he was so proud of her. And he says, as he introduces her and calls her by name, "We have been married for 63 years. And I said, called him by name, I said, "I am so happy to hear that." And as I took my seat on the front row, I turned around to say, "By the way, I like to take back to school and tell my students, when I meet people like you that have been married for a long time, what the secret is to a long life, lifelong marriage, as the Lord would have us to do." Well, before he could answer, she spoke up and said, "Now, honey, you just got to remember that marriage is give and take." And I said, "Ma'am, I have heard that since Joan and I were engaged. Because when she would come home from these teas and these showers, you know, with gifts, and after I would ask her, 'What did we get?' I would then say, 'What do y'all do at those things?' And she says, 'Well, you know, we get around in a circle, and after opening the gifts, all the ladies give advice about marriage.' I said, 'Great, what did they say?' She said, 'Every single one of them said, remember, marriage is give and take.' I said, 'What does that mean?' She says, 'I don't know, they didn't say.' And so I said to this lady, 'What does that mean?' And before she could answer, he spoke up and said, 'Son, it means that I give her what she wants and she takes what she wants. That's what marriage is like. Marriage is give and take.'" Well, that's not really it. They both had a good laugh about that. And they were models indeed of a wonderful relationship throughout the marriage, but throughout the meeting. But the point is, we constantly give, as we said, not a 50-50, but a 100-100. Then there's the purity aspect. The devoting ourselves to the Lord's will of one man for one woman for life. And even when there are mistakes made in that relationship, there can be repentance, and there can be forgiveness, and there can be restoration, and there can be salvation of the marriage relationship. But this is something to which we are dedicated based upon the principle that Paul uses in verses 26, 27, when he says that he might sanctify the church. That is to say that she might be pure. And you know, when something is pure, there's no impurity. It's like when something is true, there is no error. When something is straight, it's not crooked. And so when something is pure, when a relationship is pure, that means we're committed to the purity as we come into the church and the Lord makes us pure as a result of obeying the gospel. We're baptized into His death, burial, and resurrection, into His blood, cleansed from all unrighteousness. Well, so as we enter the church and are made pure, then as members of the church entering marriage, then we want to be pure in our relationship. I know you're wondering about this. Well, I didn't really complete the idea. On some screens I've had before, the second statement has the line, "Thou shalt not commit agriculture." Well, let me tell you the story behind that. This happened in one of our congregations in Nashville a number of years ago, where a Sunday school class was studying the Ten Commandments. And there was one that a little guy had trouble with, and on the way home, as his dad was driving, mom was in the front seat, little sister was over here, he was back here. He says, "Dad, I got a question for you from my Bible class this morning." Dad said, "Okay." He says, "What does it mean, thou shalt not commit agriculture?" And I wish I could think as quickly as the father in this story responded. He said, "Son, that just means you don't plow in another man's field." And the little boy was perfectly satisfied. I wish I could think, Ed, as quickly as that. But the idea of being pure in our relationship with God and pure in our relationship to each other. And again, we need a whole lot of forgiveness, even in a pure relationship. And we need a whole lot of forgiveness. And we need a whole lot of help, not only from our own individual mates, but also from our family, our friends, and from the church. This is God's ideal plan based on Matthew 5:32 and 19:1-12. You're familiar with these passages. One man for one woman for life. And it's hard, in fact, impossible to improve upon that. Verses 28 through 30, Paul talks about caring, that a man cares for his wife, that a man takes care of her, and that as he does so, when he is mindful of taking care of his wife, he is really showing love for himself. And he talks about, for instance, a man does not deliberately hurt himself, and therefore he would not bring harm or bring hurt to his wife as well. I've used the word compassion here as a broad concept for a lot of different principles that I think Paul is addressing. There are some in our audience today who are very familiar with marriage counseling. I know that all of you who are ministers here have had a great deal of experience with counseling, and especially marriage counseling. The number one thing that is often mentioned as problems in marriage is the lack of communication. You can do a top 10 list of problems in marriage, and rather than money being the first on the list, rather than sex being the first on the list, communication is first on the list. And I hope the Lord is not giving me a warning here. But anyway, as you think about the importance of communication, we have no problem communicating while we're dating. And then if we're not careful, after the wedding vows are said, we return from the honeymoon, we settle down to real life, we can get into our own interest and really not talk to each other all that much. Men in particular can keep things to themselves, not express themselves nearly as much. And sometimes the greatest need is just simply to reveal one's heart, reveal one's soul. I don't know if you ever had the opportunity, I assume that you did, to get to hear Paul Harvey broadcast. It was Paul Harvey broadcast down here as well. For 40 years, once I discovered Paul Harvey, I tried to listen to him every day that I could at 12 noon. And when Joan was teaching at Jackson Christian and our kids were growing up at Jackson Christian School, they would be off to school. I would make my way home right at 12 noon and I would fix my little meal at lunch and listen to Paul Harvey. One day, Paul Harvey revealed this. He said, the latest communication research shows in these United States that for the average American man, he uses 8,000 words per day. Now, that'd be a lot for some guys, right? But 8,000 words per day. And then there was that characteristic Paul Harvey pause. He says the same research shows that the average American woman uses 24,000 words per day. I enjoyed that so much. I come from a very strong mother and five older sisters, Joan and Monica, our daughter. So I enjoyed that. And of course, I should have known better, because when I got home, or when Joan got home that night, and we were having dinner, and the kids got up and went to their rooms, and we were still sitting there, and you know, she's asking about my day. I just simply said, well, would you like to know what my man Paul Harvey said today? She said, sure. She's been struggling with fourth graders all day. You know, she's happy to talk about anything. I said, well, he said, average American man uses 8,000 words per day, and the average American woman uses 24,000 words per day. What do you got to say about that? She said, just like this, it doesn't surprise me. It takes us three times to explain things to you. That's Sister Joan. True story. I told you I should have known better. But you know, really, there's a lot of truth in that. We do have sometimes those who use a lot more verbiage than others. But we need balance in that, and we need to reveal our hearts and our minds, our souls, our greatest thrills, as well as our greatest concerns, our greatest fears. Whatever there is needs to be shared with the one that is sharing our life, and that will make our relationship so much better. We have examples of couples who have lived together for so many years that to be apart from one another would be not living, really, and you've experienced everything together. You've taken care of each other. You've nursed each other back to health time and time again. You've raised children and grandchildren and maybe even great-grandchildren. And yet your love grows dearer and stronger every day. That's what the Lord has in mind for us. This idea of caring, communicating, showing compassion, and cherishing. He cherishes her and she cherishes him. And then in the last three verses, Paul talks about going back to Genesis 2, 18 and 24, about the very first marriage. God himself performing the wedding ceremony of Adam and Eve. And he talks about the principle of man leaving father and mother. That would have been difficult for Adam to have done. But following that, man will leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. I like the little lesson that I saw in a notebook that I was grading a number of years ago from one of our girl students who had taken really good notes on a presentation by our first lady at the time, Laurel Sewell. She was speaking to the girls in one of the girls' dorms about marriage, and she had three points based upon this particular passage, that marriage is God's way of leaving our original home, and cleaving to the one that we share our life, our name, and everything, and then the weaving of two lives into one. I really like that. It's for as long as we both shall live, not just for as long as we both shall love. That is God's plan. And then this quote from the bottom, the late Foy E. Wallace Jr., was a great gospel preacher. Some of you have heard him preach. In fact, you may have heard a whole gospel meeting in one presentation. I can remember as a boy being taken to one of his meetings in a neighboring county, to my home county. 2.5 hours was not unusual. Brother Fenner down here is amening, you know, because he remembers. I had 3 good naps, you know, during that sermon. But he was a great man. But the greatness of the man was not just in the pulpit or not just with the pen or not just with debating, editing the Gospel Advocate at one point, but in being a husband. When he died late in 1979, in March of 1980, there was a special issue of the Gospel Advocate that was devoted to his life because he was a former editor of the Advocate. And so when one passes, they have the whole issue devoted to his life and work. Brother Alan Hires, who happens to be our neighbor on Norchester Drive in Henderson, wrote a very touching article in that issue about Brother Wallace. And he said that when he was preaching, that is Brother Hires, when he was preaching for the Get Well Church in Memphis many years ago, that he wrote Brother Wallace a letter and invited him to conduct a meeting at the Get Well Church. Brother Wallace responded by agreeing to do so. But in the letter he said, "Now, Brother Hires, you will recall that my wife is confined to a wheelchair. In fact, she had had a stroke in 1950, and for 2 years, Brother Wallace canceled all of his appointments, and he stayed home and took care of her until she was able to travel. And then, when she was able to travel, he took her all over this country until the time of his death in 79, holding gospel meetings and so forth. He said, because she is in a wheelchair, we will need a room on ground level. Brother Hires makes the point that we secured for them the very finest accommodations that we could find. And he said in the letter, Brother Wallace to Brother Hires said, whatever you do for me will be too much, but whatever you do for her will not be enough. And Brother Hires concluded by saying, Brother Wallace could never do enough for her. His devotion to her knew no limits. Well, I didn't have the opportunity to know them in that relationship. As I said, I did go to sleep on him one time as a boy. But I cherish that particular memory and that particular information, because for him to be so devoted as a husband says a great deal to me that before her incapacity, that she must have been the example and the model of taking care of him for everything that he needed for his life's work, which was the Lord's work. And so when it came time for those roles to be reversed, he was not going to be neglectful in taking care of her till the time that he died, and he outlived her by a little bit. Well, I suggest that to you as one of many examples. Right here in Redland Road, there are examples like that. In Wetumpka, in Montgomery, in our brotherhood all over, there are great examples of that. Husband for wife, wife for husband. And we commend that as being what Paul is talking about when he says, husbands, love your wives. Show loving leadership as the wife is to be in submission to your leadership based upon the order of creation, based upon what Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 2 of the woman being the first to fall into sin and all of that, that there is submission there, but there's got to be leadership there that is agape leadership. And then I close our study with this statement, marriage is for those who love God and each other, which comes from the title of a book of one of my most influential people. In my 3 years as a student at Freed Hardeman, the chairman of the Bible department was the late Thomas B. Warren. Brother Warren was known as being not only a great gospel preacher, but also a defender of the faith. He had a PhD in philosophy that prepared him to debate and to defeat atheists whenever he could find one that would take him on. And yet he was a very practical man. He had a model marriage. He had a model family. And his devotion to Sister Faye and her devotion to him was one of those lessons that we learned much more outside the classroom than we did in the classroom. But he had this little book that was published about the time that we were students there, and all of us were getting ready for marriage, and we all got our own copy and still cherish it. Marriage is for those who love God first, and then who love each other. We like to remind our students, as they're in this very important time period of life, that not only are they dating, but they're also dating in view of marrying, which is what happens at college age, that you should be looking for someone that you have absolutely no question about their love for God. And once you are convinced of their love for God, even above you, and especially above you, then there will be other things to consider. You know, I mean, obviously compatibility and all those kind of things are important, and that's what dating reveals. But does this person love God? That's who marriage is for, and then for those who also love each other. Today we sing to encourage anyone who needs to respond to the gospel of Christ for whatever reason there may be, certainly to become a Christian by repenting of your sins and confessing your faith in Jesus and being baptized for the forgiveness of sins. But it also is a time for us to renew ourselves as we sing together to the vows that we made first to God. Our vow, when we made the confession of faith and we became a Christian by being baptized, we make a vow to God to be faithful to Him and to be faithful to His will. And as we've already said, we need a whole lot of forgiveness and a whole lot of restoration in living the Christian life. But it also is a time that as we make a rededication and reaffirmation of ourselves to God, that we do so to our mates, or we do so to our family members, we do so to parents, to children, whatever our relationship may be, that we want to be God's son, God's daughter in whatever our role. Maybe someone needs to come back to the Lord. Maybe someone needs the prayers of brothers and sisters for strength in a very trying time. This is why that lessons issue in invitations. Because we're not here just because we have nothing else to do. We're here because we want to be moved to act based upon the facts and the commands and the promises of the gospel message. So if this applies to you, it is our prayer that not only will your life and will your marriage, but also your soul be right with the one who loves you so much that he gave his only son that you might live with him eternally while we stand and while we sing.